So we've we're approaching the kind of like the culmination of our journey into the Bodhicharya Avatara. You could say we're approaching what's historically considered the most challenging part of the text, but also the whole point. So as I mentioned earlier on in the week, often you'll find that in commentaries people say, this bit is complicated, we'll skip it, which I find somewhat dissatisfying. Cause if this is what they say the most important bit is, then okay, maybe we can't fully do it justice, but let's, like, just to skip it feels like a little bit of a cop-out. So let's start with Mr. Antal Serb. Antal Serb was a 20th century Hungarian author. He says, that complicated non-entity, the ego, is always with us, of which one can only speak in terms of protective gentleness and tender irony. That complicated non-entity, the ego, is always with us, of which one can only speak in terms of protective gentleness and tender irony. So, of course, the Buddhist tradition goes a bit further than that. It speaks of destruction of the ego, letting the ego go, all of that kind of language. But I suppose I thought the reason I wanted to start with this is because Ante Sangharakshita would be explicit, but there's a substantial danger with the language of destroying the ego, cutting the ego up. It was one of the points of tension he had with established Buddhism when he first came to the UK, when he returned to the UK. There's other points of tension as well. But at that time, people, a influential Buddhist, English Buddhist translator used to talk about cutting bloody chunks of the ego off. And Bhante Sangharakshita's observation was, actually, people weren't doing that. But for the story, there's a lot of kind of violence, self-hatred, all of that kind of stuff. And it's like, well, doesn't really work like that. So, particularly the protective gentleness and tender irony. So as we head into this the most challenging aspect of the Buddha's teaching, let's try and remember that towards ourselves, towards each other. I have a high degree of confidence that a more gentle and tender attitude will see greater ground won and greater ground sustained than a violent assault on our identities. So we'll be coming back to that quote a couple of times throughout this morning. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to spiel, 40, maybe 50 minutes, then we'll have a tea break, and then I've got some exercises and questions for you to engage with in a spirit of protective gentleness and tender irony. So, in thinking about this morning, I've probably departed more from the core text of the Bodhicharya Avatara than anything else we've done this week. In a way, trying to get to grips with what is most important, what's really trying to be said here, and what is useful for us to hear. Rachasara asked me a very useful question the other day. She said, "So, what do you actually want to communicate?" So the Buddha in the Dhammapada: many people, out of fear, flee for refuge to sacred hills, woods, groves, trees, and shrines. In reality, this is not a safe refuge. In reality, this is not the best refuge. Fleeing to such a refuge, one is not released from all suffering. So this is the core purpose of Buddhism, is the reduction of suffering, freedom. You could say the reduction of suffering and the increase of freedom, they're sort of on a, they reducing suffering increases freedom. That isn't always true. Personally, I like the language of freedom more than the reduction of suffering. But reducing suffering is ultimately the purpose. A reduction of suffering gives rise to an increase of freedom. So this is what Buddhism's about. This is the point. So particularly when one is faced with complicated, difficult, philosophically abstruse subjects, it's really, really important to go back to what the point is. So the purpose of the Buddha's teaching is to reduce suffering, our own and everyone else's. And that, in Crossing the Stream, Sangharakshita's got a very interesting essay towards the end of it entitled Where Buddhism Begins and Why It Begins There, where he really goes into why suffering is, in a way, it's a central question of human experience, because it's immediate, it's real, and it's what actually drives all our other activity. So, it's possible to create, huge philosophical systems of thought, of speculation, all of these different things. But all of them are actually a basic response to the simple fact that we experience suffering, we don't like it, we want it to be different. So actually going back there it's got a clarity and a cleanness which is helpful. So of course this is basic Buddhism, isn't it? We hear this in the Dhammapada, so it's not just Shantideva who's saying this. So we experience suffering. But what are these refuges which we flee to, these trees and groves and sacred shrines? Throughout human history, we externalise experience, don't we? So in a sense, it's like, we have our contemporary equivalents to that? Jobs, relationships.
Sex and drugs and rock and roll.
Sex and drugs and rock and roll, indeed. So that's the external manifestation. But of course, the internal manifestation, which is what Buddhism is most primarily concerned with, is that we flee to the refuge of self, me. And the belief that we are real, permanent, unchanging entities, devoid, where it's possible to find satisfaction and happiness. So I forgot to write that on my flip chart earlier, but we're talking about the three lakshanas, this kind of core Buddhist assessment of experience, that we want things to be permanent, to not change, and to not result in our suffering. And the whole problem is that everything does do those things, and we don't like it, which is why we suffer. So in some senses, the Buddhist tradition is therefore pretty clear, actually. It's like, stop grasping onto yourself, stop grasping onto certainty, stop trying to make things which can't be satisfying, permanent or unchanging, stop trying to do that, and it'll all be all okay. So as you might have noticed, again, one of the things Sangharakshita says, he talks about in The Good Friend. So the doctrine of no self here is kind of like this core, it's like the desire for certainty. I'm using the phrase desire for certainty when I'm talking about not self. Such is the case with the doctrine of no self. Difficult as it is to understand that things are void of soul, self or ego, to put that doctrine into practice is more difficult still, to realise it most difficult for all. For no matter how clearly the intellect may be able to conceive this or any other doctrine, while the individual remains uninvolved with it emotionally, all his intellectual understanding is as useless as a train without fuel. The difficulty which confronts the spiritual aspirant is not so much how to understand the doctrine of no self, as where, in his experience, to discover the rudimentary form, at least, of its emotional equivalent. The difficulty, repeating that last sentence again, the difficulty which confronts the spiritual aspirant is not so much how to understand the doctrine of no self, as where, in his experience, to discover the rudimentary form of its emotional equivalent. So that's good news, isn't it? Because as you might have noticed, those of you who've tried to read chapter 9, it's really philosophically complicated, abstract, and it's arguing about things which you don't even know what the argument's about in the first place. So one of the better introductions I read to this said, effectively said, don't worry about it, focus on the core point. So the core point is this, we grasp onto certainty and that causes us suffering. So this major grasping that we do is, thinking about how to say that, but the major point is that we grasp onto a certainty about ourselves, who we are, what we are, and that impacts on how we relate to the world. And that is the cause of our suffering. And that takes place on all kinds of different levels. We grasp onto the identity of our gender, our nationality, our personalities, our physical bodies, all different kinds of things. And so later on this morning, I'm going to be inviting you to reflect on that. And I suppose particularly one of the things as I was thinking about this is noticing where there's the strongest level of emotional and psychological energy invested. So some things aren't really worth questioning. There's not enough to be gained from undermining them. Other things are very, very... we're very, very strongly limiting our experience of freedom, so there's a lot of mileage to be gained from undermining them. Yeah, ultimately, the Buddhist tradition, Shantideva is saying, is that we need to see through the way in which we construct our experience. But a lot of that is relatively harmless, and in some cases, frankly, helpful. Thinking about this earlier, like if you could say my intention this morning is to invite you to undermine certainty. Yeah, so I'm inviting you to undermine certainty. There's some forms of certainty which are positively harmful to be undermined. So for example, I could encourage and invite you all to undermine the certainty about the difference between the colours green and red. If I successfully achieved that, we'd all probably be dead before we got home. So that wouldn't be a very useful thing to have undermined. It's objectively true, isn't it? If you want to have a go, then you can... well, in a way, it's interesting. So if you want to have a go, you can go to a... If you Google purple dress, gold dress, there's an Instagram... When you get home, Google purple dress, gold dress, and you can have an interesting experience of your perceptual experience being undermined. I certainly did, because it's a picture of a dress somebody just posted on Instagram, and for some weird variance of the way that light's reflected, approximately half of humanity experiences it as being purple, and the other half experience it as being gold. And it's the same picture. I know this because I was looking at it and saying, what's the big deal? It's a purple dress. Showed it to Sung Matty and she said, it's a gold dress. And it undermines your conception of reality. Because I'm like, because it's purple. It's not like it's, is it, you know, whatever. Is it turquoise or is it green? You know, those known kind of edgy situations. It's like purple and gold are really different colours. Anyway, so that's the objective, to undermine certainty, where we find it, particularly in terms of emotional and psychological certainties, because those are going to be the greatest sources of suffering, of holding. So why do we need to undermine this? Because we hold on to stories about ourselves, about the world. And you might be thinking, do I do that? In what ways do I do that? Well, in some ways, this morning, the purpose of this morning is to investigate for ways in which you do that. I'll give you a little example. So one of the things that Shantideva refers to in this is notions of purity. So you might think that notions of purity are very... it's all to do with a caste system. We don't do that. I'm not so sure. So I remember on my first... on my first ever week-long meditation retreat, my first week-long retreat, I was in for morning, it's at Vajraloka, and I was kind of walking around the retreat centre before we started, and I was reflecting on Vimetta Bhavana and the invitation that Vimetta Bhavana gives us to go beyond our limited selves, go beyond the separations we create. That's why Vimetta Bhavana is such a useful practice for this kind of work. So as I was reflecting upon all of that, I walked down the steps, and I became across a big, fat, juicy slug. Blech. And it was right in the middle of the pavement. And I thought, ew, I don't like that. I experienced distaste, disgust, you could say, at the sight of slugs. So I stepped over it and carried on walking around. And my reflection on the Vimetta Bhavana continued, and the desirability of extending love and kindness to all sentient beings. And quickly I noticed a discrepancy in my thought patterns. And I thought, that poor little slug's right in the middle of a path at 10 to 7 in the morning, when a whole load of people are going to walk down these steps in a rush to the shrine room. He is in a dangerous and trepidatious situation. I should go and rescue him for the good of all sentient beings, or certainly for his good. So I carried on walking around the retreat centre to get to him. And the next thing I was thinking, if he'd have been a snail, I don't experience disgust in relation to snails because they've got a nice hard shell, so you can pick them up without getting slime on you. And I would have picked him up and moved him out of the way. But he was a slug, so I experienced disgust, so I didn't do that. So I got round to the point in the path again, and you can guess what I saw. Dead slug. Yeah. So that's a very small story, isn't it? But can you see that's an expression of of our literalism, of our stories shaping reality? So my story about the relative desirability of touching slugs as opposed to snails resulted in the death of this slug. You know, absolutely, undeniably guaranteed. If I hadn't experienced disgust when I saw that slug, it would have still been alive. Wouldn't have been alive today because that's 20 years ago, but it would have lived its healthy life. So we create stories, and our stories shape experience. So coming into ourselves, of course, there's the stories, I'm depressed, I'm this, I'm that, I'm fat, I'm thin, I'm beautiful, I'm rich, I'm poor, I'm funny, I'm shy. Yeah, we tell all of these stories to ourselves, and they define our experience. So this telling of stories, this constructing experience, what we're doing is we're layering simplified versions of reality onto experience. Julia. So like the experience of Julia is unimaginably complicated. The multiplicity of conditions arising and passing away, it will do your head in to take in Julia all the time. So we just say, Julia, done, bosh. Oh, look, there you go, Julia wears purple, that's nice. That's how I know it's Julia. So this is definitely the core of a problem when it comes to the point of experience. But that's not the whole story. So this, I think, is one of the most revolutionary books which I've almost finished reading. I really, really recommend it. It is a bit hard work. So the neuroscience component of it, I've read those bits twice and I still don't understand. But I'm going to read some of it to you because I think it's good. So we're talking about the way in which we, the point here is the degree to which we construct experience and we overlay labels onto our experience, simplifying and necessarily distorting experience. Fei Zhu and her students have demonstrated this experientially by showing objects to 10-month-old infants, giving the objects nonsense names like wug or duck. The objects were wildly dissimilar, including dog-like and fish-like toys, cylinders with multicolored beads, and rectangles covered in foam flowers. Each one also made a ringing or rattling noise. Nevertheless, the infants learned patterns. Infants who heard the same nonsense name across several objects, regardless of their appearance, expected those objects to make the same noise. Likewise, if two objects had different names, the infants expected them to make different noises. This is a remarkable feat for infants because they used the sounds of a word to predict whether objects made the same noise or not, learning a pattern that transcended mere physical appearance. Words encourage infants to form goal-based concepts by inspiring them to represent things as equivalent. In fact, studies show that infants can more easily learn a goal-based concept given a word than a concept defined by a physical similarity without a word. Yeah? So what she's saying there is that this capacity to label and identify experience is present in 10-month-old children, and it helps them pattern their experience. I don't know about you, but every time I think about this, I find it bloody amazing. Any animal can view a bunch of similar-looking objects and form a concept of them, but you can show human infants a bunch of objects that look different, sound different, and feel different, and merely add a word, and those little babies form a concept that overcomes the physical differences. They understand that the objects have some kind of psychological similarity that can't be immediately perceived through the five senses. This similarity is what we call the goal of a concept. The infant creates a new piece of reality, a thing called a wug, with the goal of to make a ringing noise. From an infant's perspective, the concept wug did not exist in the world before an adult taught it to her. This sort of social reality, in which two or more people agree that something purely mental is real, is a foundation of human culture and civilization. Infants thereby learn to categorize the world in ways that are consistent, meaningful, and predictable to us, the speakers, and eventually to themselves. Their mental model of the world becomes similar to ours, so we can communicate, share experiences, and perceive the same world. So what I like about that is, the celebration, it's so easy for the kind of like this idea, we label things, we fix things, that's the source of suffering, silly old human beings, aren't we a bunch of numpties? And what we're saying is, this is the defining feature which creates the possibility of human experience. This is our greatest tool, this is our greatest strength, the fact that we can abstract. It is also, unfortunately, the thing that causes us all the suffering as well. But I suppose the reason I like that is because it's, well, in a way, it's just in the spirit of this Antal Serb quote, protective gentleness and tender irony. It's just really remembering to, this tendency to negativity, to criticism, to giving ourselves a hard time. It's amazing. The human mind is unimaginably amazing. Be celebrated. So what's all this got to do with Shantideva and the Bodhicharya Avatar? It is for the sake of understanding that the sage taught this entire collection of preparations. Therefore, in the desire to put an end to suffering, one should develop understanding. It is agreed that there are these two truths, the conventional and the ultimate. Reality is beyond the scope of intellection. Intellection is said to be the conventional. Ordinary people see existent things and also imagine them to be real. That is to say, not as an illusion. It is in this regard that there is disagreement between the ordinary person and the spiritually developed. Even the objects of direct perception, such as visible form, are only established by popular consensus and not by a valid means of knowledge. That consensus is wrong, for example, the popular view that impure things are pure. So that's verses 1, 2, 5 and 6 from chapter 9. Oops. So we're back with these ideas of relative and absolute. You'll remember them from the conversations about the bodhicitta. And what Shantideva, well, this is technically called Majjhimika Prasangika, but that's the posh word for the philosophical position that Shantideva occupied, was so you've got relative experience, which is ours, which is black, white, ros, shuddhakirti, da la la, all the things we experience. And that is necessarily limited, confused, constricted, characterized by insubstantiality, impermanence, and an inability to provide lasting satisfaction. So that's one side of the divide. And then on the other side, we've got absolute experience, which is free from all of those things, open, pure, free, untrammeled, undefined, the open dimension of being, all of that kind of language. And what, and you remember that what Shantideva was saying is that we need to act on the level of a relative bodhicitta in order to realise the absolute bodhicitta. And he's saying a similar thing here, not in those, no, he does say in those verses, we need to use relative reality to access absolute reality, to find, to find freedom. So we've got it on the level both of like reality, how things actually are, and teachings which go about accessing this. So here we come to a, in a sense, an immediate problem, is that human beings are extremely literalistic. And for relative reality, what relative reality is literalism. So we take things literally, that's a problem, ros, fixed, box. But of course now we're talking about two things and our minds literalise those. So relative reality is bad, rubbish, don't do it. Absolute reality is good, pure, that's where you should be. If you're in relative reality, you're bad and wrong. So, which is unhelpful, I think. So you remember the other day as well, I was talking about wrong views, limited but helpful views, and freedom from views. So this kind of core Buddhist model. I think, I'm a student of Sangharakshita's, which is why I think this, but I think what is unimaginably helpful about that is it breaks this this tendency to polarization, to dichotomy, to certainty, to black and white thinking, binary thinking, that's what I was looking for. We're such binary thinkers. It's so strong. Right, wrong. Good, bad. And in a way, this is where you get to this whole kind of like double bind thing, because Shantideva is saying, stop thinking in binary ways, and then we think in a binary way, and then we feel bad about it, and we get trapped in this kind of circle where we just go down a rabbit's hole. Which is why this conception of limited but helpful is so useful. Because it's a stepping stone, it's an opening up, it's rather than it being black, white, right, wrong, perfect, not perfect. Perfect, not perfect is a real bind, isn't it? Because if perfect's over here, everything, you're always wrong because everything you do is imperfect. So this is where we need to work, which we'll talk about in a minute. But just to say something else about that. So for example, one of the things I get asked on a semi-frequent basis is... So this is a relatively new person or somebody who's being a bit deliberately provocative, but I think they ask a good question. So they say to me something along the lines of, I thought ego, Buddhism was about going beyond the ego and going beyond identity. And I say, yes, it is. And then they say, so why is it that you identify as a Buddhist and have a funny name? Isn't that just an expression of ego and identity? Ha, gotcha. But effectively, depending on how provocative they're feeling, they sometimes say, ha, gotcha. That wasn't true. But here we come to this. That's why I think this is so simple. This is such a useful model. Because otherwise we're just like, oh yeah, it's a wrong view. Like, it's all. It doesn't really matter. It's like, you know, whether you call yourself a Buddhist or a Christian or a this or a that. None of it really matters. They're all just labels, and they're all wrong. And what you need to do is just sort of magically ping into a world where you're completely free from labels, but then how does that even work? What would that look like? How do you know that you're there? So that's where limited but helpful views come in. Like, I'd obviously believe that identifying as a Buddhist, being called Dharmashalan, is, like, clearly that's a limited view. It's like there's an edge to that. There's me here and there's a world out there. But it's more porous, it's more open, it's more flexible. It therefore leads me out of this kind of binary position into a position of nuance, of gradient, which is where freedom lies. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to get... We're here. We're back there. That is messy, it's complicated, it's real, it's possible. So what does Shantideva actually invite us to do in the course of this chapter? Granted that something which causes suffering causes fear, but emptiness allays suffering, so why does it cause fear? Granted too, fear may come from any quarter whatsoever if there is something called I. If your position is that there is no I, who can be afraid? The teeth, hair, or nails are not I, nor is the bone, nor am I the blood, neither the mucus, nor the phlegm, nor the pus, nor the synovial fluid. I am neither the marrow, nor the sweat. I am neither the lymph, nor the intestines. I am not the rectum, nor am I the excrement or the urine. I am neither the flesh, nor the sinews. I am neither heat, nor wind. I am neither the orifices, nor in any way the six consciousnesses. So what Shantideva is talking about is a thoroughgoing investigation of anywhere where we hold on to identity, where we hold on to certainty, and undermining that. That's what he's strongly encouraging us to do. And what he was just describing there is a very traditional Buddhist practice of going through the physical experience, the self, the body, and just asking is, like, am I here? And you can, in a way, you can try this. It is a practice which there needs to be a reasonable, if not a substantial, body of metta before you start engaging in. But you can experiment with it. And in some ways, you can do some quite extreme things. So you can imagine your finger and say, okay, so cut my finger off. Is that finger me? Is it not me? Am I... The finger isn't me, but I'm still me, even though the finger's gone. And you can do it more and more extreme ways. Like I say, that's a practice which... one needs to have a healthy level of self, emotional positivity before you start engaging in, because he can take you to some slightly confused or distressing places. What we're breaking down is certainty, is self-referentialness. I'm a big believer in this, but I'd like to encourage you to consider doing it. In thinking about this particular teaching, I was thinking about it more in terms of emotional and psychological truth. And in some ways, the self is a bit of a big lump to break off. So what I'm going to invite you to do after the tea break, which is rapidly approaching, is what I'm going to demonstrate now. So really, remember, the core problem is suffering. So what is it that causes us suffering? What is it in our experience which causes us suffering? So I've got an example from the other day, which I've been thinking about. And this is this story I have for I'm lazy. I'm lazy. And then most of you know how this goes, because I talk about this quite a lot. So I say, I'm lazy. And then Maitrasara says, no, you're not. You work really hard. And basically what happens is, I don't know if this metaphor is going to work. So I imagine this is a bit like, because I know very little about chemistry. So do you remember your chemistry lessons? And you have these big, heavy molecules which only have one chemical bond. So the thing about one chemical bond is they're very hard and they're very hard to change. So in some ways, my story of laziness is a bit like that. It's very hard, it's very solid. There's not a lot of flexibility. So effectively, say, I feel like I'm lazy. Maitrasara says, no, you're not. And it just bounces off because I'm like, but I feel that I am. Nothing happens. It's boring. It doesn't go anywhere. So that hasn't worked, has it? That hasn't, you know. No, there's no freedom there. There's no transformation. There's no reduction of suffering. So this is where, this is an adaptation of, Shantideva encourages to kind of like look into things and say, okay, so you think you're a you, but there's all these different bits of you. Where is the you-ness? Where does the you-ness lie? So when I start thinking about laziness, I was doing this the other day, I thought, well, what are the components of this view of laziness? What is it that makes it up? And then things got a bit more interested. So for example, there's, I generally wake up at 8 o'clock and get up somewhere between 9 and half 9, which is, that's a bit embarrassing, isn't it? So, it's like, so that's a bit, that's like a smaller thing. And there's a few more kind of chemical bonds there. There's a bit more kind of that can be changed there. There's other ones. So this is the most, one of the more uncomfortable ones. One of the reasons I think I'm lazy is because all of my colleagues spend a lot more time doing admin for me, and I think they're resentful of me doing less admin from them. So that's, the rest of the team can tell me whether that's true or not later. But it's like when I think about that, it's like suddenly there's life there. It's like, I know there's some freedom there because it's uncomfortable to say that out loud. And I'm scared what might happen as a result of me saying that. So it's all of you like, I'm lazy, it's just, it's boring, nothing happens. Suddenly I'm like, oh, okay, well, Dhammashaw is going to come up to me afterwards and say, yeah, actually, I suspect Dhammashaw I won't say that, yes, you don't know what doing a fair thing, because I have a kind of feeling what his take on that would be. But he can tell me afterwards, and that'll be interesting.
I could tell you that.
I'm not ready for that level of kind of let go. So anyway, you kind of get the point. You kind of break it down and you find all these different views. And what, like I said, this was where the metaphor might not work for you, but it feels like they've all got, there's a lot more kind of chemical bonds there. There's a lot more possibility for communication, for change. So one of the ones I was thinking about the other day was, it's like, sugar. Don't do that. So I was thinking, what's at the heart of this story of laziness? And it's like, at the heart of it is I haven't worked out how to put this into words. It's like, it's for, I really care and I want to make a difference in the world, and that scares me. Like, I'm scared of helping people be free. I want to help you be free, but it scares me. And so I hide behind this kind of facade of laziness and not really doing as much as I could do, because it keeps me safe. And when I think about that, I'm like, ooh, okay, no, that definitely feels uncomfortable. But if it is the discomfort of openness, it's the discomfort of expansion, it's the discomfort of growth, it's the discomfort of the possibility of freedom, of transformation. And then, but, you know, anyway, carrying this metaphor, so then suddenly this big thing of laziness is kind of broken. And all of a sudden, there's just all these little kind of molecules, which can all be, they can be assimilated, they can be changed, they can be transformed. And all of a sudden, it's like, oh, I don't, that story which I've been carrying around for my adult life is not so true anymore. It's vast freedom. That's, I've investigated it. I've let go of clinging. You know, like, I so cling to that story of self around that. And the core of it is, often, it's like, oh, yeah, it's because I care. I care. And it scares me to care, so let's hide behind it. So in some ways, this particular thing is, some of you might have been wondering about why Shantideva bangs on about all beings being empty all the time and the sort of like insubstantiality of everything. In a sense, I think this is why it is, because we get so trapped in the field of certainty of time that it's a bit overwhelming. That might not make sense. I haven't quite thought about how to express it, but I'll give you an analogy. So this is from a book written in the 90s called What the English Are Like. This wouldn't be true anymore, but one of the questions they asked people in the 90s is, it was commuters. You know, people, some of you probably do commute, but particularly people commuting into London. So they stand on the same point on the same platform every day, and every day there's somebody else standing over there, and they never talked to them. And they asked people, why don't you talk to them? And they said, because I might have to talk to them tomorrow. Like, seriously, that's it, you know. It's like we project permanence and future onto things, which inhabits the ability to change and to unfold in the moment. So in some ways, I think this is what Shantideva is getting at. Why the Bodhisattvas, why we need to let go of this sense of particularly of permanency through time, because it just inhibits the chance to try things, to do something different. Yeah, it inhibits the possibility of change. Yeah, the Bodhisattvas described it being like a being at play, you know, at play in the universe. And the reason is, and I think this is paradoxical, is because they don't take things too seriously. So if you think about this image of play, well, it directly relates to being a child playing games. So I'm sure you've all had this experience of playing games, particularly with, like, kids when they're, I know, like 9, 10, 11, 12, where there's a lot of emotion invested in what's happening in the game, and their emotions are substantially kind of out of control. Whereas you as an adult, you're just like, yeah, we're playing this game, but I'm not that bothered, I'm not that invested in it. So it's that kind of freedom of perspective that we're being invited to have. And I think this is the tricky bit, because it's freedom of perspective while still caring. And personally, well, I think that's why that's an awakened perspective, because I find it very difficult to imagine not being emotionally invested but still caring. It's like, for me, it's like I'm still in a binary thing with that. It's like you either care, you're either emotionally invested or you don't care. The idea of caring without emotional investment, I find quite mysterious and quite hard to get my head around. So we're being invited to investigate certainty. Just to tell you another little story, if you're still thinking, how does that work, or why would that bring freedom? So one of the things we're undermining is, and maybe this gets into this thing, it's like what we're undermining is the degree of self-investment we've got in the experience that's happening. So a couple of years ago now, I was in a situation where I'd screwed up, I'd not done something, and the person who I'd not done something for, it was emerging that I hadn't done something, and the person who I hadn't done something for, it was about organising an event, I might have told some of you this story before, they were really, really unhappy with me, and they were making it known, they weren't shouting at me, but they were definitely unhappy, and there was quite a lot of emotion being expressed. And it was a really unusual experience, and in part I attribute it to being slightly ill. And it was public as well, so it wasn't just I was being told off in private. It's like people were walking backwards and forwards. They weren't a continuous view. So it's like there's a lot of opportunity for my self-identity to feel threatened, and for me to close down, and for me to just say back off, leave me alone, not interested, or just roll over and say, yeah, I'm evil and bad and wrong. But what happened was that I was a bit ill, and I just didn't take it personally. It was a really unusual experience. So it was quite a lot of emotional energy coming at me, and I was just able to, like, very clearly say, yep, I've screwed up, that's my fault, I should have done this, I shouldn't have done that. So it's like, it's not like I didn't care, but I wasn't trying to defend myself in any way. It's just like, yeah, you're right, I shouldn't have done that. And then what happened, which is, this is getting back at what Shantideva was saying earlier on about conditions, I suddenly saw the way in which this was just such a continuation of particularly the other person's own conditions. It's like all of the times, knowing from a little bit, not super well, all the times throughout their life when they felt unappreciated, unrecognised, unvalued, dealt out of situations, not given the credit or the value that they were due. And I could just see, it's like, this isn't about me. It's like, you've just got all of this story, and I'm just the latest character in your kind of your personal unfolding of reality. And it was a moment of insight, and I was just able to say, yeah, I'm really, really sorry. Let's do this differently. Let's turn this around, which we more or less successfully did. And I thought, this is freedom. This is not taking things personally. This is not being identified, and it's better, frankly. Okay. So let's just come back to that Anatole Serb quote. That complicated non-entity, the ego, is always with us, of which one can only speak in terms of protective gentleness and tender irony. So hopefully those two stories of example stories I've just given have kind of evoked that sense of protective gentleness, tender irony. It's like the problem is because we have these such strong tendencies to fixate and to hold on. So our attempts to undermine and question our certainty, our ego identity, just recapitulate the problem of like, you're a bad person, you're holding on to your identity, stop it! It's like you're just doing the same thing again. So it's like, can we really, in our investigation with ourselves, in our communication with one another, really try and be tender, try and be gentle? I've got an extremely high level of conviction that will bring about more effective change than like, bang, you do this, splat, you do that. I've tried that in my younger, more immature days of Dhamma practice. It didn't work very well, frankly. So, okay. So just a few minutes more, then we'll stop. So, because one of the questions that arises, at least in my mind, is there's a lot of quite high level philosophy going on here, and he's like talking about the existence of the self and the dark and the primal matter at the beginning and the end of the universe and all of that. So just to say a little bit about that. Well, Sangharakshita's position, I remember, I think I asked Subhuti about 12 or 13 years ago. I asked Subhuti, who's one of the most respected teachers in our tradition, for those of you who don't know who he is, I said to him, I feel like I need to establish whether I'm a Majjhimikan or a Yogacharan, which are these two kind of core philosophical systems that this book's talking about, Shantideva's exploring. And I can't remember what Subhuti said, but it definitely stopped me worrying about all of this, which I think with to good effect. What effectively Subhuti said is that Sangharakshita's position is emphasising Pratityasamuppada, the core Buddhist teaching, that experiences arise in dependence upon conditions. Yeah, and this is seen as a middle way. So as I was saying, the danger with this kind of relative absolute teaching is that we get kind of stuck in nihilism and sort of broken. We just kind of get stuck and trapped a bit, which I don't have the philosophical clarity to sufficiently explain to you, but you can think about that later if you like. You can ask me about it. We might get further in conversation. So So Bhante's decisive contribution is to re-emphasise the importance of conditionality and see it as being the core aspect of the Buddha's teaching. And particularly it's seen as a middle way between extremes. So what are the extreme views that we hold in our society today? So that's what one of Shantideva's concerns is, addressing all of these philosophical positions. So just to give you a quick take on what I think about that, So I wonder if we could talk about naive realism and negating certainty as two core ways of, it's always eternalism and nihilism. So naive realism and negating certainty are the sort of the core philosophical challenges that we face today. So what do I mean by naive realism? I mean the belief that just by calling something, it becomes it. So it's like, if you just say something is that, It's denying the complexity of conditionality and forcing our minds onto experience. If you're thinking, give me some examples of that. One of the most striking ones came when is the Soviet Union. So in the Soviet Union, they had a very strong, as a naive realist position. Socialism works and we're going to control it and we're going to make reality be the way we want it to be. So during Perestroika, when the Soviet Union was collapsing, because their attempt to kind of impose reality on the world was breaking down, a bunch of Soviet diplomats were being shown around London for the first time, and they'd been given a tour. And at a certain point, they'd been shown this and that and the other, and at a certain point, after an hour and a half or so, one of them turned to their guides and said, "But how do you get everyone to have bread?" And the British person was just like, what do you mean? And they're like, well, you know, all of our time and energy is invested in trying to control the production and flow of bread because we've got this story about how bread should be and it doesn't work. And of course the English guys were like, well, you just have shops and people make it and people buy it. You know, like but it was such a perplexing question to them, because the idea that you'd have to invest massive amounts of time and energy controlling reality in that way was a complete, it was madness to them. So it's a defiance of conditions, an attempt to impose our minds on our conditions. So what's our kind of the emotional equivalence for us? Of that for us? Well, you could say it's, this is a point where I'm least clear, by the way, so I might not do a good job of this. It's a bit like the kind of a Facebook story, isn't it? We're imposing this story of who and how we should be on our experience, and it causes us pain. So it's an attempt to impose a story on our experience. And it's a real concern in the world today. He's called King Bibi. I can't remember what his actual name is. Just got re-elected as the Prime Minister of Israel, and he runs on naive idealism. He fixes people and says these are the problem. So it's a real force in our worlds, in our societies. What's on the other hand? On the other hand, we've got negating certainty. So this is where naive realism is denying the complexity of conditions and just saying, I want it to be like this, so it will be like this. Negating certainty is when we deny the possibility of change, where we deny the possibility that something new could emerge. So that's, the kind of the broader socio-phenomena of this is... like algorithms, which personally I feel quite concerned about, but maybe you don't care about. So for some of them it's quite benign. So I was talking to a police officer recently, and when there's a break-in, an algorithm will tell them where to go, and it's often right to find the criminal. So it's incredibly helpful. The problem is those algorithms are also used to determine what level of bail you set for criminals in the States. Guess who gets told to have high bail? Poor black guys. Yeah. So the problem is the algorithms, they deny the possibility of change, deny the possibility of freedom. How do we experience this in our own minds, in our own lives? Well, this is when we just feel, when we feel burdened and laid down by aspects of our experience. So the classic examples would be in painful and negative mental states. I am depressed. I am an addict. I am a this or a that. And we're denying the possibility of change. We're denying the possibility of freedom. We're denying the possibility that something new can emerge. So I was thinking about it this morning. I was thinking, why is it that I'm wearing a Spider-Man t-shirt? As you know, I love Spider-Man. Because he's awesome. But really, what Spider-Man represents is a profound denial of negating certainty. That's the message, isn't it? If this geeky kid who's rubbish with girls and has got a crap job can make a difference, can change, can transform. That's the message that Spider-Man gives. And that's the message of the Dharma, that in any moment, anybody can transform their minds. Something new can happen. We can be free. Negating change, yeah, denying change. So just the last word, that was a good point to end on, but I want to have one more word. So this relative and absolute, one more reason, I think the most useful aspect of this teaching is if you look at the inconceivable emancipation, Bhante's commentary on the Vimalakirti Nidesha. What he says about this is, the most important thing to understand is the absolute experience lies outside of words and concepts. Therefore, dogmatism is impossible. You can't be dogmatic because the truth can't be expressed in words. Yeah? That is a message of humility. That is a message of openness. That is a message of receptivity. That's why I'm part of the True Vatana Buddhist community, is because we explicitly say, no matter what you say, it's always more complicated than that. There's always mystery. There's always greater freedom to be found, to be explored. Mm-hmm.